Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is Craig Jones, the president of the Oklahoma Hospital Association. Given cuts in Medicare and Medicaid reimbursements, large cuts in federal reimbursement costs for uninsured patients, along with the ongoing transformation in the standards of care, technology, and qualitative outcome for hospitals, this is indeed tough times for hospitals, and particularly dire for rural hospitals. Nationwide, approximately 673 rural hospitals are considered to be on the edge. And coupled with our state's refusal to expand Medicaid, over three dozen rural hospitals in Oklahoma are thought to face a troubled future. In fact, earlier this month, the Sayre Hospital in far western Oklahoma had to close. The Oklahoma Hospital Association has just launched a new campaign to convince state officials to accept the federal dollars associated with Medicaid expansion, not into an expansion of Medicaid, but into an expansion of Insure Oklahoma, an employer-backed public-private partnership which would cover roughly the same population as an expansion of Medicaid. Craig Jones joins us from the OHA to discuss the situation facing rural hospitals as well as their new initiative. Craig Jones, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich.
At the beginning of this month, Sayre's Rural Hospital out in western Oklahoma closed. It's the 67th rural U.S. hospital to close since 2010. This despite the local taxpayers approving a half-cent sales tax to help that hospital out. What is the state of Oklahoma's hospitals today?
Well, I think we certainly continue to see certain kinds of environmental drivers that are a part of an overall healthcare transformation and transition that the field is going through. You know, this takes maybe a little bit longer to kind of get into, but, yeah. But basically, the way in which healthcare is being delivered and the way in which it's being paid for is shifting, where there is more of an emphasis on quality and outcomes rather than volume. There's more of an emphasis on, you know, lowering costs. From a value standpoint, people are looking for alternative ways of doing things. And so there are multiple processes in how care is delivered and paid for that's being changed. And that ripples through the nature of our types of organizations quite differently. When you have technology that's changing and that requires changes in equipment, changes perhaps in staffing, when you have regulatory things that are coming down and changes and restrictions in payment, that's going to impact physicians. The fact that there are less physicians being produced today than in the past in terms of the need. In rural areas, it's more difficult to attract physicians to practice there, to maintain other kinds of specialty healthcare workers. Volumes as rural communities shift in age. There's a movement, obviously, much more towards the metropolitan areas. So all of that makes it difficult to sustain the way in which healthcare has been delivered, particularly in rural communities, as opposed to the past. And we're going to need to change the model of healthcare in many rural communities.
So what I'm hearing is that really a big urban hospital is better equipped to handle these qualitative changes where you have payment. I mean, we're talking, I don't know if it's already here, but we're talking about down the road, payments based on qualitative outcomes as opposed to what a hospital or a series of doctors, what procedures they do.
Yes, that's true. And it doesn't mean that there isn't, quote unquote, good quality in small rural communities, but it gets kind of technical. But when you look at how the care is being paid for, a small shift in a few items, a few volumes in a smaller hospital with a lower scope of services can have a bigger impact. And so you do have advantages with scale, which the larger hospitals will have in terms of spreading changes and the effect of changes over a broader base. And that really is difficult in smaller rural communities who proportionately will have a much higher percentage of their business that will be tied to governmental programs like Medicaid and Medicare.
Hmm. Now, the National Rural Health Association, I think they have a report that says about 673 U.S. rural hospitals are on the edge. with the passage of the Affordable Care Act and some of the Medicaid cuts that have happened because of the sequestration, as well as the uninsured reimbursement costs going down, there's always been talk that this is going to put rural hospitals on the edge. How much of where you see rural hospitals in trouble is it from this sort of regulatory changes that you're talking about, and how much of it is due to just the fact that they're not being reimbursed the way they used to be?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. Clearly, the reimbursement is a major, major issue. From a statistical standpoint, based upon the Medicare cuts that hospitals have experienced, and part of that's related to some of the regulatory changes moving towards, as we said, outcome kind of based things, particularly money that was reduced from extra funding that hospitals receive for disproportionately treating uninsured patients. When the Affordable Care Act was passed, those extra dollars, if you will, that went in to pay for the disproportionate amount of business that you cared for the uninsured were used to pay for the ACA, because if you're going to have more patients theoretically with insurance, then you don't need those other payments. When you take those Medicare cuts and sequestration, as you mentioned, in Oklahoma over the next 8 years, we're going to be looking at about $3.5 billion. When you add the Medicaid cuts, we're north of $600 million. So you're looking at in excess of $4 billion of things that have already been enacted. That means that that payment is not going to come. And so you add that less payment at a time when hospitals are trying to transition to new modes of care, to new processes, trying to maintain staffing, trying to continue to recruit. Back to your point about the 673 hospitals that the NRHA mentioned. In Oklahoma, of that number, last year we were looking at 15 hospitals whose operating characteristics mirrored those characteristics of hospitals across the country that had closed. They just came out with their new report last month, and now Oklahoma has 42 hospitals that mirror those operating characteristics to put them at risk. We're only second to Texas that had 75 hospitals. So clearly there are conditions that are going on. Some of it's payment, some of it's operational, some of it's shift in medical and healthcare standards and things. There are multiple sides to that elephant, if you will. But the payment component of it is a significant part in helping those hospitals transition towards new models of care.
Now, I mentioned at the top that SAERS, local population, passed a sales tax to help out the hospital. It didn't help overall because the hospital had to close. But we're seeing other communities. I think Chickasha just passed a local sales tax increase to support their local hospital. Are we seeing this in the state too?
We've always had hospitals, some of the public hospitals that have, not all, but most have passed some form of local taxation to support the hospital. In the past, those sales tax dollars really were, I'll use the term, kind of the marginal of excellence. It was kind of the icing on the cake to allow for extra kinds of things or to allow a little easier mode of keeping up with capital needs, of obviously perhaps some, if it was a substantial amount of tax to help support maybe a new wing on the hospital or major things there or new equipment. Now, I think some of the communities are looking at this almost in a survival mode, and that's really a difficult situation. It all depends upon how many dollars that tax support is going to raise. But rather than looking at it as extra kinds of funds or that ability to ease your overall mortgage payment, if you will, some of the latest things are being looked at as almost kind of like, I don't mean this in a negative sense, but a life preserver to help kind of continue things. I don't look at that as bad, but I think, again, in light of that tax support, in Chickasha's case, there were some physical improvements that they were going to need to make to the plant, and so that was going to help them in that regard. I think that having those extra dollars come in, again, is a major contribution to allowing the hospital to evolve. The problem with SAERS closing is that it's difficult to transition. You know, even though Sarah might not be able to support a traditional hospital as it has been in the past, that community still needs healthcare services. And yet to transition that facility to a new model of care, let's say, well, let's say it doesn't have inpatient services, but it has robust outpatient services and it can observe a patient for 24 or 48 hours before it ships the patient upstream to a larger facility or discharges it to home health care or outpatient, it's difficult to transition an entity that is closed, that may already begin to be losing staff. We don't know what's going to happen with the physicians. So this infusion of dollars that we've been advocating helps to support and buy that transitional time to better support those local communities.
Now, I'm going to use Sarah as an example. I think there would be some people who would say, well, this hospital was uncompetitive for its community. There is a larger hospital that's in much better shape 12 miles down the road in Elk City. What is the problem with just driving 12 miles to Elk City? Even in a metropolitan area, you might drive 10 to 12 miles to get to the nearest hospital in a large metropolitan area, too.
Yeah, I don't think in some cases, Rich, I don't think that's theoretically a problem at all. I think that's the transition and the evolving of the delivery of healthcare that is occurring. As I said, I'm just using Sarah as an example, mm-hmm. not that this is totally applicable, but you have Elk City that is just 12 miles or so down the road. And so you could say, well, gosh, again, with the changing shift in how healthcare is being provided, it very well may not make sense for SAIR to continue to have its traditional hospital. And so going to Elk City or going to other larger facilities perhaps is, and probably in some cases is, the better movement. But there are certain services that SAIR needs, certain types of emergency care, certain types of primary care and outpatient services. So that's the evolvement that we think we need. We're not trying to put extra money to prop up models of care that probably need to evolve to something else. And clearly there are communities across Oklahoma that in the future will not be and probably should not continue to support certain kinds of care because they don't have the volume, they won't be able to maintain the staff or the physicians to be able to provide cost-effective, high-quality care as the standards and provisions of healthcare change.
And I guess to follow that analogy out, the other question is Elk City, the next hospital down the road, in any better shape than SAIR too?
Well, I know for a fact that it has operating characteristics that are more positive than what SAIR's were. I think each hospital, you have to look at that, each into its own. But functionally, it seems to be operating not in the same risk category that SAIR has been.
My guest is Craig Jones, the president of the Oklahoma Hospital Association. The OHA announced a new plan and a campaign called Make Oklahoma Better, or Make OK Better. It's to accept federal dollars through the expansion of SoonerCare. Now, as opposed to expanding Medicaid, explain Make OK Better. What are we talking about? Insure Oklahoma, I assume, is the private component of, although it's hard to tell where SoonerCare and Insure Oklahoma end and start.
Well, it really is not SoonerCare in the sense that most people think of SoonerCare as the traditional Medicaid program for Oklahoma. And so we're not talking about using federal dollars to put it through the traditional Medicaid program. Insure Oklahoma was established back in 2004 and is a public-private partnership where it was designed to help small employers, originally those that have 50 or less employees, and now that has been expanded up to 200 employees or less, to allow low-income people of small employers, where those small employers traditionally could not afford to provide health insurance for their employees. Insure Oklahoma allows the employee, the qualifying employee, to pay 15% of an insurance premium. The employer pays 25%, and then the state and the federal government combine to pick up the extra 60%. So you're buying private insurance, and that's the model because the ACA was originally set up where the federal dollars were going to go in to expand the eligibility of Medicaid. That is politically unacceptable in Oklahoma. And we're saying, okay, if you don't want to take those federal dollars, we're already sending tax dollars to other states to help pay for that. That's that what I was telling you earlier. Why don't we bring those dollars back to the state and use those to expand the broaden the coverage under Insure Oklahoma? That is a widely popular, bipartisan-supported program. You have people that have a vested interest, have skin in the game, if you will, by virtue of the fact that they're contributing to the premium. And so let's take those dollars and broaden coverage. The other part of our proposal is there are elements that we think we could reform in that program to lower unnecessary utilization, to better coordinate care, to build upon, quite frankly, some of the successful, innovative things that the Medicaid program has done. That could be a carryover into leveraging those reforms over a broader population within Insure Oklahoma. So it's the same federal dollars, but we're using those into an Oklahoma-based plan, which is Insure Oklahoma, that we think has the characteristics that politically are much more attuned to what Oklahomans want.
Two questions. One, would an expansion to Insure Oklahoma of these Medicaid dollars, would it cover the same number of people as a traditional expansion of Medicaid would? And two, would the federal government grant a waiver for a program like this?
To your first question, you are talking about the same newly eligible individuals. So you're talking about the same population that you're trying to provide coverage to. Secondly, there are characteristics of how we're approaching this model that would carry over into the same waiver. It would have a modification to it, the same waiver process that the state already receives for Insure Oklahoma. We would be doing things similarly to how, let's say, a state like Arkansas is doing it. Arkansas has what they call a private option. It, again, is a premium assistance program. The federal government has already approved that. So we're well aware of the conditions that the federal government would want to look at to grant that waiver. But Oklahoma really had Insure Oklahoma well before Arkansas had its program. So it's very similar in how it functions because of the private nature. So we're not concerned about really getting the federal waiver for the proposal that we've put forward.
But it will cover that same population, the people that are just above the cutoff for Medicaid up to the point where the subsidies kick in for private insurance.
Correct. It basically takes the eligibility up to what we call 138% or so of the federal poverty level. We estimate that to be somewhere in the vicinity of 230,000 to 235,000 Oklahomans that don't have coverage right now.
What's been the reception from the state? I mean, right now, there have been a lot of people who have been asking for this expansion of Medicaid, and it seems to have fallen on deaf ears from Oklahoma City at the legislature and the governor's office. Any sense that this will see a better reception?
Well, I am hopeful. First of all, we're not talking about expanding Medicaid, so that's off the table. We're talking about putting it into a plan that already has wide political support in Insure Oklahoma. I think the economic crisis, quite frankly, that the state is going through from a budgetary standpoint, when you have hospitals and other healthcare providers that are already going to be losing billions of dollars, we can show, and we've done an economic analysis through the Oklahoma State University that says over this 8 to 10 year period of time, the available federal dollars are between $9 and $10 billion. The economic analysis that they did says when you bring those dollars into the economy, it has a ripple effect through the economy. And the net impact is that those $9 billion become $18 billion. And that could generate, over that period of time, in excess of 24,000 new jobs. When you look at the impact of those 24,000 new jobs in terms of buying goods, paying sales tax, paying income tax, and so forth, even with the cost to the state, because there is a cost to the state under this program where eventually they would have to kick in a dollar for every $9 that the federal government provides. That's still a great return. But even for that $1, that amounts up to millions of dollars over course of the 8 years or so. But when you look at the ripple effect of bringing these dollars into the economy, the net gain to the state, the net gain over and above any costs, is in excess of $600 million. So we feel very positive that from a practical standpoint, this proposal can have an extremely positive impact on Oklahoma when you're already looking at a $1.3 billion deficit in next year's budget. It's not the silver bullet, but it's a significant contribution at a time when local communities are going through these cuts and changes, and the economic impact, particularly on small communities, from a job standpoint and so forth, is going to be devastating, not only to those communities, but the state. So the bottom line is, bringing these dollars into the state, we believe, has a very positive impact economically. And I think in light of the state's situation, that message, Rich, is resonating more with legislators as they look at the practical implications of our budget.
Now, one of the things, if the state decided to accept Medicaid expansion, it would save Oklahoma in existing expenditures, I think, by about $48 million a year. Department of Mental Health, it would take over funding of that, of some of their funding. Department of Corrections, the State Department of Health, would make OK better in using the federal funding to build Insure Oklahoma. Would it have that same impact on already state expenditures in those areas?
Yes, and in fact, what you said about saving the state approximately $50 million a year, that is not at all dependent upon expanding Medicaid at all. It's just bringing those dollars in and using those. Yes, the same thing would be if the state expanded Medicaid, but they're not going to expand Medicaid. But by taking those same dollars and putting them into Insure Oklahoma, it has the same net effect because, as you say, in three of those areas, mental health, the corrections, and the state health department, the state is funding 100% certain programs that would be covered by this new proposal. The OHA is actually in the process of updating those numbers to get a more up-to-date estimate as to what those savings would be. But we feel as if it definitely would free up at least $50 million that the state is spending that could be directed to other sources and needs.
Let me ask you one last question in our remaining time. Representative Doug Cox and Grove introduced HB 2665, and this has really struck a lot of people in an unusual way. It would trim approximately 111,000 Oklahomans off the Medicaid rolls, existing people off the Medicaid rolls, basically making able-bodied adults under 65 and not pregnant ineligible. What would this do to the state?
Well, I think Dr. Cox is just trying to put on the table the reality that, on the one hand, if you're going to lower, if the state has less dollars, and therefore you can put less dollars into the overall Medicaid program, you're either going to provide less benefits, you're going to cover less people, or you're going to provide less payments to the people who are providing the care. We are at a point where the federal government requires a minimum level of benefits, and we're down to that point. So you can't change the benefits. We're at a point where I just was sharing with you that over the last year and a half, there's been somewhere between a 15 to 18% cut in the payments to providers. And just this week we learned that come July, we could see another 6 to 12% cut in payments to providers. And pretty soon you're going to be at a point where physicians in particular won't be able to they won't participate in Medicaid. So I think what Dr. Cox is saying is that, look, if you can't lower the benefits and you're at a point where you can't reduce payments to the providers anymore, the only thing left is to say we can't cover all the people that we're covering. I don't think Dr. Cox wants to do that, but he's trying to say if we can't cover all the people that we're doing now, who can we look to that possibly we could pull off the Medicaid rolls? That's something Oklahoma has rarely done. And I think he's just putting the reality on the table to say, we've got to look at this seriously, because I know Dr. Cox supports the idea of trying to bring these additional federal dollars into the state.
Well, if the state decided to expand Insure Oklahoma and bring the federal dollars into the state, What would be the immediate impact on the state budget in this coming year, this $1.1, $1.3 billion shortfall that we're looking at going into the next year? Would it have a substantial impact? Would this impact be really more over a year or two down the road?
Well, that's a great question, and I don't know that I can give you a real precise answer, because a lot of it has to do with how quickly do people who are eligible, do they enroll in the program? Because you're basically shifting these dollars in paying for people to have insurance. And so we have part of the update that we're doing to not only the savings, that $50 million that we're looking at, part of our study that we're going to have towards the middle or so of March is to also look at the experience of other states that did expand Medicaid or did take these dollars and put them into broadening coverage, and what has been the what we call the uptake of the eligible people to enroll. So it is a gradual, but in some cases, Rich, it's been a quick ramping up. But it's difficult to know exactly. The first year would probably be a transitional year, and then the years thereafter would be better. But the $50 million we were talking about would be an immediate savings. But I'll have a better answer for you in about 3 or 4 weeks.
All right. You mentioned the 42 hospitals that sort of meet the conditions of sort of being on the edge, if you will, here in Oklahoma.
Yes.
If the state does nothing this year, what do you see? I mean, will a percentage of those hospitals have to close?
Well, I can tell you, I can't answer specifically about the 42, but obviously we've had one close already. I've had three hospitals tell me that they're worried about being able to stay operational through the end of this calendar year. I have another four hospitals that have been talking to us about ceasing doing inpatient services. In fact, OHA has been leading for the last 15 months or so a national discussion with several other states looking at models of care that would, again, support what I was saying earlier. The difficulty is there's not the financial mechanism right now to exactly support those new models. So we have clearly a half dozen or more hospitals that that we know are seriously looking at operational changes. And with what I just mentioned about the Medicaid 6 to 12% cuts, if that happens come this July, that will clearly impact several of those other 42 hospitals, without a doubt.
Well, Craig Jones, we appreciate your time. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich, for the opportunity.
Craig Jones is the president of the Oklahoma Hospital Association. The OHA announced a new campaign to convince state officials to accept the federal dollars associated with expansion of Medicaid into an expansion of Insure Oklahoma. For more information, visit their website, makeokbetter.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.